Good evening, everyone. I guess everyone has managed to find a seat, which is fantastic. Very nice to see so many of you to show up this evening. I'm delighted to welcome you all. I know we do have people online joining as well as in person. If I may just ask people to mute themselves as you're logging into Zoom. So, I mean, first of all, really just to do some brief housekeeping. This event is going to be recorded live. So anything that you will say, you will have the opportunity to present and put forward some questions to our honorable guest. This is going to be recorded. So just so you know and are aware, in case you don't want this to be recorded, please don't speak up. This is an LSE event, which is hosted by the Global Surgery Policy Unit, which is a partnership between LSE Health and the Royal College of Surgeons of England. We are operating at the LSE. You are free to speak your mind. We are promoting free speech, but please be respectful in whatever you're asking, whatever questions you're asking or points you're raising. My name is Rocco Friebel. I'm the director of the Global Surgery Policy Unit. I'm a health economist and a faculty member here in the Department of Health Policy. And it's really my pleasure to introduce today's guest, honorable guest, Dr. Peter Mbah. Peter Mbah is an international maritime lawyer. He's a businessman, a politician, a public administrator, and a philanthropist. And lately, he's been elected to be the executive governor of Enugu State in Nigeria. Before taking up his political appointment, he was the chief executive officer of Pinnacle Oil and Gas Ltd, Nigeria's most dominant downstream oil and gas company. After obtaining his law degree in London at the University of East London, he was called to the Nigerian bar and awarded a Bachelor's of Law of the Nigerian Law School. He proceeded to acquire different master's degrees here in the UK at the University of Oxford, in Spain at IESE, University of Navarra, and completed several other additional executive programs at Harvard and other well-known universities. He holds an honorable doctorate degree in political science from the Godfrey Okoye University in Enugu. But most importantly, we're really delighted to hear about his vision for the state of Enugu, his bold political visions for education and health development. So please join me in welcoming Peter.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for such a generous introductory remark. Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, let me express my profound gratitude and my deep appreciation for the honor to invite me for this lecture. It is not often that one has the opportunity to speak before a robust and richly diverse audience such as this. And indeed, at an institution with remarkable and illustrious history as the London School of Economics. So I want to thank immensely the organizers of this event. In the next 40 minutes or so, I would strive to demonstrate the best tradition of leadership and insight for which this institution has earned global renown. Another 40 minutes or thereabouts would be devoted to clarifications and questions arising from the lecture. As I expect this to be interactive, I invite you to think about the questions as I progress. While preparing for this lecture, I took time to look up the motto of this great institution. I found the statement, "To know the causes of things," compelling. This motto, according to the LSE website, was chosen to reflect the institution's founding purpose for the betterment of society. Often we gloss over the messages as we carry on with our daily lives and fail to internalize their prospect as a result. But it's important to note that they are not simply perfunctionary adoptions. They can act as a northern star to our values and aspiration. The betterment of society fittingly inspires us and sums up the broad purpose of this lecture, and to a large extent, the essential goal of every pursuit of humanity. During our campaign, we adopted a motto that makes a very bold declaration: tomorrow is here. What do we mean by that? Tomorrow is here holds us to the fact that every decision we make now affects our future and the future of our children. Of course, this begs the question, what future do we want? How do we want to prepare the soil for the generation to come? What will be the cost of a short-term thinking, complacency, or hesitation and doubt? We need to take a visionary view of the future that awaits and take bold steps to lead our lives towards an enduring regenerative legacy. My speech is titled Enugu State, Nigeria: New Political Leadership, Bold Economic Vision, and will highlight mostly the people-centric philosophy, specifically in regard to the health and education strategies we've deployed in birthing a new narrative for Enugu State, over which I currently preside as governor. Boldness is a word that best defines the vision we're implementing in Enugu State. The single boldest projection that encapsulates what we intend to accomplish is our target to grow the Enugu State economy sevenfold. Simply put, our vision is to grow the state's GDP from the current levels of $4.4 billion that we met it to $30 billion in the next 4 to 8 years. Another bold plan is the commitment to attain a 0% rate in our poverty headcount index. Just a quick fact about Enugu and Nigeria. Nigeria is Africa's most populous country with a population of over 200 million people, and indeed the continent's biggest economy. It has a landmass of 923,000 square kilometers. Located in Nigeria's southeast, Enugu's population is approximately 7 million. The history of Enugu is indeed a history of Nigeria's evolution from pre-amalgamation, pre-independence, and post-independence. Enugu attained preeminence in 1907 after the discovery of vast swathes of coal deposits by British geologists. By 1909, a rail line had been built to haul the extracted coal from Enugu to Port Harcourt. That development made Enugu a fledgling economic hub and was a catalyst for the sustained migration into the town recorded in the early 20th century. These emerging economic clouds also made Enugu an inevitable center of administration in colonial Nigeria. In contemplating Nigeria's presidential federalism, I would draw an analogy using this short story. Imagine, if you will, a farmer and his wife who both have 36 children. Yes, I know you would look at that as a lot of kids, right? They are all of working age, but he sends only 6 of them to the fields. Over time, these 6 grow tired. Some get sick, and the other 30 begin to suffer and starve. Even before the onset of age, such scenario could breed resentment, as the active 6 may perceive the fact that the rest do not work as a sense of entitlement, and therefore not their own expense. A likely outcome would be general indolence. Our federal system evokes an imagery akin to this story, not least in the sense that it dulls creativity and induces a near perpetual dependency syndrome, which ultimately leaves everyone in a state of want. Is it then surprising that the family has fallen into hard times? Shouldn't that have been an opportunity for the family to overhaul its production strategy, given the opportunity that could be born out of crisis sometimes? Distinguished guests, as governor of Enugu State, you could say I represent one of those children. This anecdote roughly encapsulates the Nigerian dilemma. Of course, the monthly subventions to states from the federal purse are still being disbursed, but they are only sufficient to the extent that a state's priority and projections remain on a modest trajectory, the sort that is capable of yielding only fairly predictable incremental change, but can hardly inspire any bold vision that can result in a rapid social and economic development. So such a socioeconomic pattern is evidently not sustainable any longer. While our choice of presidential federalism system might have been well informed, shaped by inherent benefit of federalism in other countries with population as vast and diverse as ours, it has, however, bred a system where revenue is excessively domiciled at the center rather than in the states or regions. This puts intense pressure on the source and almost cuts off the supply. We are gradually seeing concrete moves towards a truly devolved polity, facilitated in large part by the political outlook of Nigeria's president, who, as governor of Lagos State, championed the push for fiscal federalism. As a matter of fact, we have witnessed some constitutional amendments resulting in sectors like electricity and railways, once the exclusive preserve of the federal government, becoming a shared responsibility between the states and the federal government. There are at present ongoing discussions to enthrone additional devolution of power. Despite this promising development, these challenges yet speak eloquently to the need for a socioeconomic rebirth that repositions federating units like states as potent agents of development. This is an important thread of my governance philosophy. I've always believed that an enduring and impactful change is never a chance happening. They are typical product of a painstaking process and radical thinking that reflects the understanding that the exigencies of our time require an unusual solution. Among these challenging solutions are rising cost of living crisis and insecurity. There's no doubt that this period is a life or death moment for us. Given Nigeria's youth bulge, the bleak reality that confronts us if we do not take appropriate remedial steps is terrible to contemplate. The question then is, what do we do? At the heart of our socioeconomic challenge is the issue of leadership deficit. This has always been the bane of our development. Despite widespread clamor and yearning for leaders with transcendental values, leadership failure remains a recurring issue. But true leadership is about the people, an unwavering willingness to be accountable to them and to be transparent. A good leader should not merely peddle empty hope and platitudes, but must demonstrate a capacity to translate dreams into reality. This briefly summarizes our turnaround tale in Enugu State in roughly 9 months. For us, the most important first step lay in realizing that any set of solutions that failed to upend the status quo across the sectors will not suffice. That basic understanding helped us to boldly set forth at dawn and imbued us with the requisite clarity of purpose as well as resolve. We started out with three things: a bold vision, clear direction, and then we assembled the right people. Before I delve in more depth into the radical strategies we adopted in health and education, let me highlight three areas we had to tackle in order to properly entrench our plans and prepare for meaningful change. They are namely water, infrastructure with a focus on roads, and then security. Water. We demonstrated a firm commitment when we set an audacious 180-day timeline to solve the perennial problem of water scarcity in Enugu. For context, this was a challenge that had proved intractable for decades. We delivered on that promise within the time frame. It wasn't because it was an easy task, and neither was it because we were eager to bask in the afterglow of public acclaim. The motivation was simple. We wanted to enthrone a situation where the provision of basic amenities was taken for granted. Our objective was that potable water flows in every home once the tap is turned on. From a mere 2 million liter daily water supply to Enugu residents, we grew the daily water supply to 120 million liters. We were, in addition, driven by the enormous social toll that water scarcity exerted on our children. This was always an unbearable thought. I'm aware that the time children spend in search of water is very much the time they would have spent studying. The enormous amount that businesses spend to purchase water from vendors was an unnecessary addition to their operating costs, with adverse effects on their bottom line. Rhodes, such bold commitment was no less obvious in our promise to build up to 1,250 kilometers of road over the next 12 months, which was a radical departure from the trend that typically saw just 100 kilometers built each year. We are simultaneously building dual carriageways alongside numerous urban and rural roads, running into hundreds of kilometers. One of the daunting challenges that confronted us was insecurity, fueled by bands of criminals who had more or less conferred on themselves the status of parallel states. We tackled it head on and literally recaptured our streets and communities from the grip of this gang-like social order that had almost become normalized. It was imperative that we did this. It was obvious to us that to attract the investment necessary for our economic growth, security had to be a priority and could not be treated as an afterthought. In one of their most audacious moves, these non-state actors had enforced an illegal sit-at-home campaign in the region every Monday. How could we, for instance, convince would-be investors that our state was secure and that they need not worry about the safety of their personnel if people were prevented from going to work on certain days? It may sound bizarre, because it was a bizarre situation. Imagine a situation where a brand of outlaws imposed their will on citizens, unleashing mayhem and dictating what days they were permitted to work, go to school, or trade. That was the unfortunate situation we were beset with. Businesses shut down and relocated in droves. Students could not write their exams, and people could not, in fact, go to hospitals. But it wasn't simple. It wasn't simply about the possible effect that their so-called sit-at-home order could have on inflow of foreign capital. The Nigerian Constitution expressly notes that the primary responsibility of government is the security and welfare of its citizens. So a government implicitly loses its reason for being if such absurd state of affairs is allowed to persist. We didn't have to think twice to stop the illegality. We set out with a strong determination to bequeath enduring legacies, and some of the results are already coming in. On a regular basis, we glimpse reports, including from independent bodies, that validate our reforms and investment across the sectors. And what we see is quite reassuring, an indication that it certainly has not been a false dawn. This brings us to healthcare and education, the main areas of focus for this lecture. Healthcare. Investing in improving our capacity to deliver quality healthcare was a major priority for us, as the wellness of the state's workforce could either make or mar all the objectives we had set for ourselves. the saying that a healthy workforce is a motivated workforce is by no means an empty cliche for us. That explains the numerous projects and innovations we have launched across Enugu State. Our philosophy with regards to our investment is simple. Our objective is to ensure that every child in Enugu State has access to quality healthcare. We're seeing decline, albeit marginal, in infant and maternal mortality rate in our state. We are constantly eliminating factors that ordinarily cause maternal and under five deaths, such as the absence of skilled birth attendants, including doctors, nurses, and midwives at our health facilities. From a pre-election statistics of 39%, we have grown the number of beds attended to by skilled health personnel at our facilities to 42%. Our target is to achieve a 100% threshold by the end of 2025. In addition, we do not compromise on the issue of training for our medical professionals, as their competence and capacity will be central in driving the achievement of the ambitious objective we set for ourselves. We have significantly expanded immunization coverage for all childhood vaccine preventable diseases for children in their first birthday. We have also increased the number of those attending antenatal care for the first time. These encouraging performance indicators are a direct result of measures we are taking to raise our healthcare delivery to optimal levels. We're also building a level two healthcare facilities across the 260 electoral wards in our state. Each center has the necessary equipment, sanitation, and hygiene facilities, water, living quarters for doctors and nurses, and alternative power supply. Where there is a shortfall, especially with regard to doctors and nurses who have been emigrating to the West in large numbers, we carry out regular recruitment drives to narrow the deficit. The goal is to bring the number of doctors in our state to the WHO recommended doctor to patient ratio of one doctor to 600 patients. The prevailing statistics for Enugu State when I was sworn in was one doctor to 1,867 patients. Interestingly, given that the average ratio in Nigeria is one doctor to 3,500 patients, the figure for Enugu State might have been deemed as pass mark, but would rather not find solace in such dismal statistics. We're quite intentional with our goal in this regard, to progressively bring that number even below the WHO recommended ratio. Another significant achievement of our health sector reform is how we have successfully digitized patients' records in our hospitals. So even when patients visit other facilities, their record could still be assessed digitally because of the seamless connection we have introduced by migrating patients' details to electronic medical record platform. The deployment of ICT is visible in our entire governance structure. Besides promoting efficiency, it has strengthened due process as we transit from a manual regime to a digital experience. Our goal is to have a paperless system. It is gratifying that this has begun to take a firm root in our ministries, departments, and agencies. Education. Education is another sector where we have taken some radical steps consistent with our pledge to enthrone a system that bequeaths to the child a body of knowledge comparable to the best global standards. Our government's allocation for education in this year's budget illustrates this resolve. Our state's budget of 158 billion naira for education is the highest per capita in the country. With regard to the percentage of total budget assigned to education, it is as well the highest budgeted for education by any state in Nigeria, at 33% of the entire budget sum. It is also substantially higher than UNESCO's recommended benchmark of 15 to 20% of total annual budget. I dare say it's perhaps highest in the world. Think about it. This implies that for every 100 naira we spend, 33 naira goes to the education budget. Our investment in education is carefully conceived and implemented with the knowledge that the envisioned turnaround of the state's fortune is contingent on the existence of a robust education sector. No nation has ever risen above the inherent capacity of its public education. It is this philosophy that underpins our smart schools project, which we're setting up in each of the state's 260 electoral wards. So we're not just changing the narrative. It is truly a dawn of a new era. From age three, we ensure a child is enrolled in a system that imbues them with the requisite skills to compete in tomorrow's world today. That is because pedagogy has largely evolved from an era when the goal was apparently to ensure the child is able to memorize what has been taught. Today, however, children should be able to practicalize what they have learned. This is a core philosophy of our Smart Schools initiative. I consider this quite profound. Given that such experience is already commonplace in the West, this might not sound like a big deal, but it would help if we contextualize our past and present experience. The prevailing situation in our public schools before now was anything but impressive. Many pupils sat on the floor to listen to teachers who scribbled on blackboards with barely any modern teaching aids. Schools had no libraries, no restrooms, nor any of those facilities that confer on them the expected dignity as center of learning. In fact, a baseline study we conducted revealed that 50% of our children could not read after 4 years in primary school. Those who managed to read could barely comprehend. A similar deficiency was seen in numeracy skill, with 50% of our children unable to apply simple skill of subtraction after 6 years of primary school education. Of course, this situation isn't peculiar to our state. It remains a problem across the country. Another grim data that confronted us was in regard to the number of out-of-school children aged 6 to 11 years. The 82,051 figure of Enugu State is alarming. We found the number totally inexcusable and knew that it was imperative we took some radical steps. As I earlier emphasized about the importance of knowing the causes of things, we sought to know what could possibly be the reason for such unacceptable state of things. Poverty was a major factor. It wasn't thus a surprise that a poverty and inequality index survey conducted by Nigeria's National Bureau of Statistics had put the poverty situation in Enugu State at 58%. So our Smart Green Schools initiative is a bold and creative response to the learning crisis that confronted us on assuming office. This is because we have created sufficient incentives for parents to send their children to school, not least of which is our free school for pupils. The Free School Meal Plus incorporates a medical program through which vital health statistics of students, such as growth profile, sundry deficiencies, and vaccine status are monitored. This helps us to ascertain pupils that may require further medical intervention. Each smart school features an interactive digital whiteboard, an internet system, robotics and artificial intelligence center, modern ICT center, two science laboratories, hybrid multimedia library, creative production studio, 25 inclusive classrooms, and 700 Android tablets. Through this, we expect to impart experiential knowledge and bridge the skills gap that leaves our students with grim prospects in a globalized world. The emphasis is threefold: access, relevance, and quality. The motivation is to see that what our students are taught is relevant to modern day realities. This is crucial because we see our teeming youth as a latent, powerful engine for innovation, economic growth, and sustainable development. It wasn't just sufficient to have the learning tools and the environment conducive to learning. Equally crucial was having the necessary manpower. Our recruitment of teachers was painstaking. This reflected in the fact that only less than 100 teachers out of about 1,700 who took the practical test eventually made the cut. So to scale our experiential learning reform, we are establishing a Center for Experiential Learning and Innovation, call it CELI. This would develop, introduce, and incentivize collaborative engagement in innovative challenges by students, teachers, as well as industry and business partners throughout our education system from basic to tertiary levels. The CELI challenges will introduce breakthrough technologies and design solutions that connect with our strategic priority for growth and development, including agriculture, energy and mineral resources development, commerce and business, urban and rural infrastructures, creative industries and tourism, and information and communication technology. Through experiential learning and innovation, our educational institution will catalyze priority innovation and technology, incentivize development of 21st century skills and competencies, and support human capital and workforce development to fuel our economic growth. As we develop the Center for Experiential Learning and Innovation to drive strategic development priorities and ensure quality and transformative education, we are inviting select international universities to collaborate with Enugu State academic and research institutions to co-create technologies, digital solutions, and generate digital badges. micro-credentials, and degree certificates to provide academic and vocational training to support startups and incubate businesses, and to enable our youth to not only overcome poverty, but also contribute to the fourth industrial revolution. For sure, no one can actually tell what the future holds, but we can largely discern a society's future prospect from how it treats the well-being of its young ones. In taking ample steps to grow our students' capacity through a transformative learning process, we can truly speak in a very reassuring tone regarding the future of Enugu State. Our trajectory is yet proof that progress does not just happen, nor is it simply wished into existence. Efficiency is attained through scrupulous planning and moral courage to discard the inefficient ways of the old, even if people have grown accustomed to them. For long, our quest for development was blighted by an abject failure by politicians to match rhetorics with commensurate action. It seems to all intents that the people were perpetually obliged to endure the dismal cycle of politics characterized by what the late governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, had described as an unabashed tendency to campaign in poetry and govern in prose. Beyond the fact that they seldom wrought any significant change on the Human Development Index, perfunctory government policies only served to reinforce public cynicism. From the outset, we resolved that there would be no room for platitudes. You might be wondering, how are we able to achieve all this? And also, where all the money is coming from? I assure you, this is not pie in the sky. We have focused on three areas, and our success in those areas has been crucial. The first is plugging leakages through automated system, enhancing quality of our services. So we deliver more, we earn more, and we deploy resources wisely. Expanding our tax nets. Are we borrowing excessively? Certainly not. Only 10% of the funds have been borrowed. Our internally generated funds account for the rest 90%. In addition, we are harnessing our dormant assets and resources that were as yet unexplored. This has certainly not been a walk in the park. Ours have been a tale of bold and amazing courage. Distinguished guest, the quest for a better society may sometimes seem far off, but the truth is that every new discovery or hallmark achieved is yet a fresh chapter to new beginnings. Confronting that new beginning is a task for which education, such as that offered by the London School of Economics and similar illustrious institutions, have equipped their students for. The scale of technological advancements in our world today might sometimes lure us to complacency and create the erroneous notion that there is barely any frontier left to conquer. Such mindset would be a great disservice to the learning you have acquired. Those whose inventions have changed the world seldom grasp the level of impact their ideas would have on humanity at the outset. So you are certainly not a blip on the radar. As you step out in the world, your education should be a constant reminder that there is always room to do things better, to shake the fabrics of the status quo, and not to be content with the usual. History shows that humanity's progress has always been attained through an interrogation of the status quo. You may have heard this countless times, but it's often worth reiterating. Fortune not only favors the bold, but also the prepared mind. There is no doubt that imbibing the ethos as espoused by your institution actually prepares you for fortune's favor. Thank you so much for listening.
Yes, I'm open to invite you to just take a seat here in the front.
Thank you so much for this very inspirational and insightful presentation. I would like to welcome my colleague, Dr. Marty Lord Ifeanyichi, to the stage. He's my colleague in the Global Surgery Policy Unit. He's an assistant professor specializing in the financing of healthcare systems and the economics of healthcare systems. And I will hand over to you to guide the next discussion. Thank you.
I'll probably stand or sit on existing protocols, but I must still, and thanks to my director, Roko. If you look at this, you see that I'm not the chairman of the secretariat, I'm not the chair, so thanks for generously donating your seat to me for this engagement. And Your Excellency, I must welcome you to this occasion. I mean, in addition to the comments of my director earlier, for me, it's a personal honor. So I'm happy to have you around and you and your team. You're welcome. And to all the our attendees, it's good to have you this evening. It's good to have you. It's good to have you this evening. So you're welcome. Your Excellency, I'll probably just go straight. It's great to hear, it's exciting to hear the amazing things you're doing in Enugu and the things you've done within the first few months you got into the office. Like the issue of security, I knew about the seat at home and how it was. It nearly crippled the economy. The water problem there, because I also live, was there. I know what it is like. And the infrastructure you referred to, even before talking about health and education. So I would say congratulations for the success so far.
Thank you.
And for the audience, maybe I need to do a disclosure here. For some of us in research, you want to submit a research paper, typically you're asked to declare any conflict of interest. I think I need to declare, at least for transparency, that His Excellency is the governor of my state in Nigeria, Enugu. So maybe that helps you to understand some of the probably some biases and sentiments that could actually shape the conversations. But I can assure you, I promise you that I will keep it really professional and academic and keep out personal sentiments. So help me God. Your Excellency, I will move straight to the discussion, and I will focus mostly on health, and it's for obvious reasons. I mean, that's my fault. And for people that know, I will go straight. I see you've done a whole lot of stuff in primary healthcare, immunization, skilled bed attendant, building 260 type 2 health centers across all the all the works in the state. That's amazing. People that know me know that I'm very passionate about health financing. The only thing I do from morning till night is talk about health financing. And a bit of background to my question. I'll just start from there. A bit of background. Nigeria actually introduced a health insurance system in 2005, and for probably almost till 2000. Since then, actually, we've remained at 3 to 5% coverage. In 2022, we actually signed a new National Health Insurance Act. And this time around, it made health insurance mandatory and also provided funds, special funds for the vulnerable group. And for the first time, created a clear mechanism for how the national system would work with the state's health insurance authorities to actually move coverage forward. I mean, for those that know Nigeria, you have a federal system. So you have states like 36 states, and then you have the federal system. And the states actually have strong autonomy to a very large extent. So the new National Health Insurance Act is really very fantastic. It's amazing. But at the end of the day, you also realize that the devil is in the details. When it comes to implementation, that's where you have the issues. And I feel personally that the states are actually, those are the weak points. The success of that national act depends on what happens at the state levels. The last year, we actually had a similar engagement with Ministry of Health officials here at LSE from Nigeria, and some of them actually were heads of state health insurance agencies. So it was actually accepted that many states already got health insurance agencies working to actually take health insurance coverage to the grassroots. From there, I'm coming down to Enugu State. With everything we are doing, with the investments we are making there, that's the supply side. And what we see is that a lot of times the demand side dynamics do not receive a lot of attention. I mean, this is what we've seen from our experience and the literature and all of that.
Okay.
And it's important that aspect is important because if we build all of this and they are not able to access, probably for financial reasons, then it becomes a problem. And that is where universal health coverage comes in. The whole idea is to, if you have health insurance or if you have a universal health coverage, it means that with the link access to health from ability to pay or financial or socioeconomic situation. With that context, I'll probably be asking Your Excellency, what is the situation of health insurance scheme in Enugu State? Where are we at the moment and where do we want to go and how do we want to approach this? What are our strategies? How do we want to see that we actually make it possible that even with all the things we are building, the poor can actually access the care, the services, without thinking about financial catastrophes or financial challenges?
Thank you very much, Doc, for that question. So you're right, we have the National Health Insurance Act. So for that to become operational in a subnational or in a state, you would need to, first of all, domesticate it. So by your own instrument of law, you have to make it your own law. So I can tell you that we've domesticated that. So we do have the Universal Health Coverage Law in Enugu State. So we do have the legal framework that makes it mandatory for people to be covered. However, you've just raised an issue. How do we ensure that we get people in that basket, that coverage? So health insurance is a product. And so what you're trying to do is sell product to people. And the cost of procuring a health insurance in Enugu is very minimal. It's about 12,000 annually. So what it means is you pay just 1,000 naira every month to be covered. So it's quite minimal. But the real challenge, and this is what we're trying to address by making sure that because there is already a demand pool in the health space. What you are lacking is the level, the service level you're providing there. So we think that the service level as it stands is abysmal. So we need to elevate the quality of services. And that's why we've looked at it, that we need to build the confidence of people to believe that when they procure that product, that insurance, that they are able to get efficient and effective service delivery. And so we're going from building brand new level two or type two primary healthcare center. And as I said, it's not really, we're not so much enthused about the infrastructure that we're putting in place, but the facilities and also the manpower that we have to get. So if you look at all the new type two healthcare centers we're doing, there are quarters for doctors, for the healthcare practitioners, so they are in-house. So you're able to assess service 24 hours. So if we're able to build the confidence, we currently have just about 50,000 enrollees in our universal health coverage subscription. So our target is to move that to 1 million in the next 1 to 2 years. So by the time we're able to put these services, increase the quality of services we're providing, we are going to then have the moral rectitude to enforce this law, because the law exists. You know, we can begin to engage the employers, even the states. You're going to make it mandatory for your civil servants to enroll in that system. And you can even structure it in such a way that the deduction is at source. Okay, so there would be different strategies for enforcement. But the first thing we want to do is to make sure that the quality of service we're providing is high, that people would naturally be attracted to, you know, procuring that product, that insurance. Thank you.
Wow, that's interesting. Thank you very much. I absolutely agree that for us to really get the buy-in, there has to be somehow like a way to build trust. And then I agree that the quality of the service actually available, it's very, very important. And I also think that that would also require a lot of sensitization, a lot of campaign, a lot of mass education to really get the people to buy into this. Chair, please let me know. So the idea is I'm going to just give him one or two, three questions, and then we throw the floor open for general conversation. So I'll probably just finish up with it, but let me know if we are taking too long. So I'm still on around health. You made allusion to, you alluded to this issue, which is brain drain. And brain drain, like you already said earlier, it's a very big issue in Nigeria currently. As at December last year, we have an estimated, like let's say 12,200 Nigerian doctors in UK alone. And within 7 months last year, we had almost 1,200 Nigerian doctors getting registered with GMC within a space of 7 months. So you have almost like 200 in one month. And this is, I mean, it's not an any good thing. It's a national thing. And of course, those figures don't include the ones in the USA, the ones in Netherlands or Australia, Saudi Arabia. And the interesting thing is that even doctors are actually moving from Nigeria to some other African countries, Gambia, Sierra Leone. And of course, what about the nurses, the pharmacists, all the other health workers are moving. So it's a national thing. It's not peculiar to Enugu. But what we also see is that there's a scramble for health service providers among those that at least within the country, across the different states. The worrisome thing is this: even in the schools, and the College of Medicine, people in third year, fourth year, fifth year in the medical studies are already planning or writing USMLE or PLAB I've known people that have written USMLE in fifth year in Nigeria. But so just to also get down to the question, in Enugu State, I mean, given this scramble, while we say the country is really trying to fix the entire problem, how do we, I mean, because all these facilities we are looking at, we need manpower for that. You also mentioned you have regular recruitment, which is very important. A question then is, how do we really make sure that we retain the retention? What are our strategies to attract amongst the people that are still back, get them to our state, and then keep them there and at least try to keep them as much as we can? So what are the strategies here we are looking at?
So there are both two things that you may argue could be responsible for the brain drain. One may be extrinsic and the other intrinsic. Okay, extrinsic because you may look at the material benefits these migrants, those that are migrating feel perhaps they would earn more if they left the country, and so they are attracted by the extrinsic value of moving out. And then intrinsic, again, some of them do not see professional satisfaction back home. So they're looking at the equipment where they need to develop themselves, and they don't see those equipment available, and they're not getting that job satisfaction. You know, as a professional, you want to be able to have the tools to express your competence or your profession. So you could argue that there are those two. And so what we've done, first of all, as Quick Fix, and this is something that has cascaded from the federal. So they have asked most of the schools, colleges of medicine, and the teaching hospitals to expand their facilities. And so they've increased the quota, if you will, of their intake. So that's something they've seen as a quick measure. So for example, in Enugu, where we have the College of Medicine and Teaching Hospitals, we've just recently increased our, built new facilities. So we're able, our quota for intake now is increased to double. So if we were admitting 200 students, we're now able to take 400. So that's just a very quick fix, radical measure to solve a problem, But ultimately, I think looking at it from the medium to short term, and in addition to increasing our quota, what we have also done is to look at the welfare. So if you notice, I made a lot of references to building staff quarters, making sure that there are ways, because the issue of remuneration is not something that is, is within the exclusive list under our federal system. So it's not something a state can unilaterally alter. So that has to come from, the national, from the federal government. But there are ways you as a state can also enhance the welfare or the well-being of your workforce by providing all these other elements. So if you provide accommodation, you are monetizing that value. So what they would have ordinarily spent in accommodation, they are saving that. Okay, so another welfare. So that's what we're essentially doing to retain our workforce. But yes, the step the federal government took in expanding the quota is a quick measure, and that is already also helping, because we also have our nursing schools, which just recently we've upgraded to College of Nursing. So we're also trying to expand the number of intakes there. In our primary healthcare space, we are also doing a lot of recruitment of the community health extension workers. So beyond the nurses, we're also bringing in people within the communities that can be trained to be able to deal with issues of antenatal and birth and all of that. So we're adjusting to to these losses we're experiencing through migration. Again, the country can also, you know, take advantage of that if we are able to get this our service levels right. There's nothing wrong from, you know, we can also design that as a strategy for foreign revenue earning. If we're producing more than we need within the states, by all means, we can export and make money from it. So the first step, I think it's a very credible step, is a step in the right direction, seeing how we increase our quota and intake. And so the number of people we're training is a lot more than we were before now.
Interesting. Yeah. Good stuff. I mean, just picking up on the last point you made about probably even getting exporting and getting resources. I mean, one of my colleagues, in our unit, Mess Cream, is actually pretty much very much involved in workforce studies. And one of the things we've been looking at is actually whether if you have this huge population of, let's say, doctors, Nigerian doctors in the UK, whether there's a way the government could have arrangements to actually have Nigerian government or as a country actually benefit something from UK in return. But I mean, that's a conversation we can actually continue later on, for want of time. So moving forward, in terms of, there's a whole lot of things going on, I mean, at the primary healthcare level, which is amazing. That's good stuff. Since the Amata Declaration of 1978, I mean, everybody has been a whole lot of attention on primary healthcare. And I mean, I think some WHO figures estimate actually say as high as 75 or 80% of all our issues, ailments actually can be dealt with at that level. So it's a big thing. It's a good thing. I'm just trying to like zoom out a little bit and bring out some kind of systems thinking around the whole thing. I'm just wondering, above the primary level, at the system wise, like, do we have, what is happening at the general hospital, secondary level? What's happening at the tertiary level to be able to actually handle the referrals that are supposed to come from this, the lower level to up to that places? And I think before, to even have a picture of what we are doing at the various levels, I've always struggled with defining the primary structure of the healthcare system in Enugu. In some places, for instance, have cottage hospital. Personally, I'm not sure what we consider as our first level hospital. In some places, you have cottage hospital, for instance. And in some places, you have district hospital. Way back in, let's say, 1990, I think under Dr. Chinwore Kinyamani, there was an attempt to really reform the system and bring in the district health system. So you have like two local governments within a constituency that forms a health district, then you have the district hospital. I don't think that was continued. Mm-hmm. So you have a mix of system. In countries, let's say Tanzania, Zambia, where you have clearly defined district health system, you have all this health post, health clinic, health center. Then at the apex, you have your district hospital. So it's the first level. And then from there, you have the secondary one or the regional ones like in Tanzania, or then up to the tertiary level. What kind of vision or structure are we envisaging? What kind of model are we looking at in our own system, in our own state? And then if based on that, okay, so how do we work to see that the entire system works like a unit, you know? For instance, we have referral infrastructure, whether it's price cycles, whether it's real ambulance to move patients from this level to the other level and to the other level. And at every point level, how do we make sure that whatever cases are coming here, there's adequate capacity there to deal with this? The reason why I'm saying this is, For what we know already, I mean, from our work, the healthcare system is what we call a complex adaptive system. That means that oftentimes one factor intervention sometimes is more likely to face policy failure, policy resistance. But when you look at it as a system and then approach it comprehensively, you're more likely to get results. So how do we imagine the entire system?
So you're right. You pointed out something very critical, and which was why it appeared as if there was such a concentrated focus on the primary health. We felt if we were able to address those diseases, if we were able to nip them in the bud, then it would be less expensive for us, because if you're able to deal with all those those primary healthcare challenges, then it would cost less. You won't have to deal with the morbidities and the comorbidities if you're able to handle those other elementary, if you're able to have access to those elementary cares. So what we have done is we do have the level 2 primary healthcare center. Just on top of that, we have the level 3. The type 3, as we refer to it, primary healthcare center is almost akin to a cottage hospital or a general hospital, if you will, which is at the secondary level. And we have about 41 of those. We have 41 of the cottage and the general hospitals across the states. We have 17 local governments. So you can imagine we have more than 2 in some local government of the secondary healthcare. Now, what we're currently doing with this process of digitization and digitalization as well, is we are trying to also introduce telemedicine so we can have people access a secondary healthcare from the primary access. So if you went to a primary healthcare center in a rural area, with the digitalization we're introducing, the EMR platform that we're building, you can actually get referral to a doctor who will view your profile and be able to, you know, you can get consultation from that point. But we also have something that is even radical. We have a huge market in the health or medical tourism space. And part of our campaign promise is to take some good share of that market. So we're building what would become maybe the best hospital in West Africa, in Enugu now. That hospital was conceived by my predecessor. The superstructure is there. So we're now looking, we're about getting to that point of financial closure on the funding for these. The structure is already there, the superstructure is already there. So we're talking about just getting the equipment and then resourcing it with human. So that is ongoing. That is at the tertiary level. As you know, we have the State University of Medical and Applied Sciences. By next year, we're going to elevate the status of that university to a teaching hospital. We have the Enugu State, of course, the College of Medicine and the Teaching Hospital, ESU. So those are all at the tertiary level, and they are all operational and functional. But what we're then doing, which we're now going to work with the private sector, is trying to get a huge chunk of the market share of the medical tourism by building this world-class medical healthcare center. That is, you know, as I said, once we reach a final investment decision and the funds are deployed, within 18 months, it's operational, because a lot of the work have already been done. The structure is standing. We're going to be just looking at equipping and you know, basically doing the finishing works. So it's a holistic thing. Whilst we are paying attention to the primary healthcare space, we're also thinking about the secondary and the tertiary spaces as well. So we're not leaving them out. We understand the value, but we're also going to take advantage of technology in terms of our EMR, and also the fact that those services can be provided even remotely. And then, of course, if we have to move, we do have ambulance services that we can evacuate if we need to move from one location to another. Okay, so those are essentially, in a nutshell, what we're doing in the medical and healthcare space.
Amazing stuff, Your Excellency, and I hope you're able to achieve all of this, and good luck. Just one thing on education before I come. Okay, all right. Okay, we go to the floor now. Okay, yes.
If you could just stand up, introduce yourself, who you are.
My name is Chika Izugu from University of Cambridge. Yes, Excellency, I must commend your bold stride in allocating, I think, the 3%, which is unprecedented in the history of Nigeria, to education. I must thank you for that. But then let's talk about the reality, some of the bold steps you decide to take. Let me start with, I think, the transcript of your speech. Is it going to be made public?
Yes.
And how do we assess that?
We're going to distribute it.
Yeah, because we also need to analyze it and see, you know, maybe do pre-post if possible.
We're going to start distributing.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for granting that request anyway. Then secondly, 10, 15 years ago, I was a consultant at Ondo State for some retail firm. And we saw Dr. Olusegun Agagun, Mimiko, did something similar to what you're doing in the education sector, where he boldly built what we call mega schools across some of the strategic location within the state. Fast forward 8 years after his tenure, the subsequent governor, I mean, of blessed memory, Akeredolu, could not sustain the funding of most of those schools. And if you go there today, they are nowhere to be found. He came up with what you call state bus for children and the likes, but the sustainability of most of those projects were not grounded on the funding and in other factors that were not accounted for. Now, my question is, most of all the stuff you've mentioned seems to me like something to, you know, please World Health Organization and Global World Bank and United Nations. How do we sustain this? If by venture you win another 4 years term, which is going to make you, you know, the governor for another 7 years, that's eight term, I mean, two terms for 8 years. The subsequent person who is coming in, whether your political party or somebody else, how do we sustain some of this giant stride you have decided to, you know, some of these boosters you have decided to take? That's one. Then number two, recently a publication was given out where we found that University of Cambridge contributed a whopping sum of 30 billion British pounds to the United Kingdom economy. And now we have Enugu State University of Science and Technology. We have UNN, you know, with different campuses. We have UNTH. We have all these universities. And I'm asking, do you think we really need a new institution? And do we need to revamp the existing ones? That's on one part. On the other part is, how do we make these universities or our institution functional so that we can pick people from there and say, okay, because most of the rural areas in Enugu State are really suffering. I'm from Enugu State, Enugu North precisely. How do we caution the effect of rural urban migration where people want to come to Enugu town for jobs and the likes so that we can sustain some of the economic gains which these guys are going to have in the local areas? So my question is, if we have Enugu State, we have also, I also worked in Lagos Business School before moving to Cambridge. We have Enugu State Business School, which is also not functional as it should be, because I think most of all these economic models you try to also talk to us about speak to the idea that we have professors in Enugu State University, professors in Enugu Business School who could propound and challenge some of this economic model and tell us whether it's going to be workable within the framework and the context of Enugu State. That's number one. And tell us if this is just World Bank or United Nations model for economic framework. Because some of these ideas from LSE, from Cambridge, from Oxford, from Harvard has put us 20 years backwards. Because we sit here and speak English, but the practicality of most of these models are not real within the concept of Enugu State. I've been to Enugu. I called people in Enugu State in my village. There is no water. And I'm saying, don't worry, the governor is here. He's still going to bring water. Let's assume that he's going to bring water. There's no road. Yesterday, there was a kidnapping in Enugu University of Nigeria Teaching Hospital. So how do we cop all this grammar and, you know, work into practicalities of implementing some of these policies? So that if, for instance, within your 8 years, by the grace of God, if you become the governor in the next 4 years again, we can, you know, put money into UNN and say, okay, you're a professor of medicine, you're a professor of virology, you're a professor of, you know, global health. Give me malaria vaccine in 4 years. What does it take? And then we can begin to produce things that will be relevant to our people. So I'm talking of sustainability, I'm talking of universities, you know, contributing money. And then the third one is the security.
Sorry, excuse me, please.
Which is also like integrated, free speech. Free speech. Mm-hmm. Now, do we tell Fulani people to leave Enugu State for open grazing? Or are you going to have an issue with the federal government, just like Akeredolu did? Will you be able to take the bold step to say, get out of our farms? We need our farmers to give us more food. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So I think I'll just take his question and then go to the next. So let me start with the point you raised about sustainability of the smart schools. So just for context, what we're doing in the education space has not happened anywhere in the country before, right? It hasn't happened in Ondo State. It hasn't, nothing close to it, right? So what we're basically mopping up all the mushroom schools, that public schools that you've known in your various villages, in your rural areas, those single bungalows will no longer be there. What you're going to have to replace them is a smart green school. So we're doing 260 of the smart school. So there would be no, so you're not going to change that, because you're not going to have any child who goes to a school where they sit on the floor, or who goes to a school without access to water, or without access to sanitation or hygiene. That won't happen by the time we're done. What we are going to essentially entrench, which is, again, these are things you institutionalize, so it's not something somebody can come and change. Because if you have the smart school built there, you no longer have the moribund schools or the dilapidated schools. They no longer exist, okay? So you're going to have to fund it. And the people will demand for the successive government to fund, because they're already accustomed to it. They're not going to take them back. So you institutionalize that. So what we are doing in the education space is that is not building schools regionally, build three model schools in the different senatorial zone and give some student access to it. No, every child in Enugu State will have to go through that pipeline. So it's not only restricted to the child of the wealthy or the of the have, it is for, if so at age three, you put them through that. And by the way, this is not a model that any multilateral institution or DFI could have prescribed for you. And as I said, the reason it appears as if we're obsessed, and that's why we're spending 33% of our budget on education, because we're doing something not done anywhere. You cannot, you couldn't have, been able to accomplish what we're doing if you don't spend that level of funds in education. I think that it would be sustainable because the people would demand for it. Now, if you talk about building capacity, and you mentioned the University of Nigeria, you know already that UNTH is a federal institution, it's not a state institution. But of course, there is that collaboration. If you listen, and I think you have a copy of my speech, we're inviting collaboration from other educational institutions for us to have engagement, enhance the capacity of our our teachers. Okay, so our job is not done yet. We're not telling you that we have a perfect situation. We have expressed ambitious goals that we want to achieve across all sectors. We've also developed strategies for accomplishing those goals. And we've recruited the right set of people to work to accomplish those goals. Are we done with security in the state? The answer is no. We're still working on that, but we have dealt with it frontally to a point where we can tell you the investors can come now. We do have pockets of breaches here and there, and we're working on it. We're going to, I don't even think that even in the United Kingdom where you live and work, that there are no security breaches every here and then. Of course, it does happen, but the government, the important thing is that you have the capability to track the criminals and defeat them. So you track them, you pursue them, and you defeat them, and you have to take them to court, you take them to court. So in terms of other infrastructure, again, we did say something. We're going to start off from the city, which is where we've increased our production from 2 million liters of water, daily production capacity, by the time we were sworn in, to 120 million. So we're just doing a scheme. So why do we have to have another school of medical and applied sciences? We do have zones. In the whole of the North, I'm glad you said you're from Enugu North, there is no teaching hospital in terms of, you know, so if somebody has a medical case where you need a tertiary medical access, you don't have one in the entire Enugu North zone. So, and that's why it's important for us to have the State University of Medical and Applied Sciences there. And as I said, we're going to elevate that to a teaching hospital because we need to have that to address those people living there. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I know we're a little bit pressed with time, but I would suggest to take one last question. Great. And if you could keep your question brief, please.
Thank you very much, His Excellency. I'm Dr. Chris Agbu, a consultant nephrologist with the NHS and the president of Medical Association of Nigerians in the UK. Catering for all the Nigerian doctors in the UK. Just to clarify, we're hitting up to 20,000, not just 12. So is the figure you're quoting is probably 5 years back. One of the things that we've tried to look at every time we talk about brain drain and all that, talk about strategies, building health facilities, but we do know that there's issue with workforce in Nigeria and transforming healthcare, that is a big problem. A lot of our colleagues are calling that they want to come over and you don't stop them from coming. So now my question is, what is the strategy for the state to attract the diaspora healthcare professional to come back? As we speak now, we have over 20% or 25% of our colleagues that have been here for a very long time, are very well established here in their different specialties, and are very keen to do a lot of work in Nigeria. We do regular activity in Nigeria with some states. Lagos State, we're having a lot of collaboration with them strongly. My question is, what is this Enugu State government doing about that? It's not about building structures. I've been in Enugu State last 2 years, spoken with the governor about a structure that was built for almost 2 years, 3 years, and it was just lying fallow. So it's actually not setting up the structures, but actually, how are we going to actually make that structure function? We can do the structure you mentioned earlier on, but do we have the capacity? Do we have the expertise to actually make it a world-class center? So I think we should be looking at brain gain. The diasporans are ready. A lot of them are ready to contribute at the individual level, group level, and association level. So I would like the governor to actually look into the strategy of using the diaspora groups to strengthen the workforce in Nigeria, build capacity. That will also help us to transform the healthcare. We're doing a lot of that with other states, so I'm more than happy to also continue this discussion with you. Thank you very much. But I think it's something that will help us to transform the health system. And I'm from Enugu State, by the way.
Thank you so much. Your Excellency, if you don't mind, I would just hand over the microphone to the very last person to state your question.
Thank you, Excellency. My name is Ini Emomobong. I'm from King's College, London. I must thank you for the things you're doing and even coming out to have this conversation. It takes a lot of boldness to do so. First, in relation to what my friend from Cambridge said, the petroleum sector has been deregulated and therefore power is becoming very expensive. And you need power for health, all of these hospitals you're talking about. And so how do you factor that into the sustainability? Because the passion of the gentleman or lady who comes after you may be different. And there's nothing, you do know how politics is. There's absolutely nothing that compels him to continue, especially with policy inconsistency, where people think that, oh, it was Mba's idea, Mba is gone. I want to do my own idea. There's absolutely nothing. The House of Assembly will listen to him, everyone, and you only sit and cry thereafter. So what's the sustainability in terms of power? Now, and again, borrowing from him, decolonization. Yes, we have tried. Where we are today is vicariously liable, and you're a lawyer. The West and our people acting as their agents have kept us where we are economically and everything. And therefore, there is a demand for decolonized thinking, decolonized solution, homegrown solution. And it helped us during COVID. The West thought that we're going to have bodies lined up on the streets in Africa because we didn't have healthcare. But it turned out that it wasn't so because we simply resorted, because there was no help anywhere. We resorted to homegrown indigenous knowledge, and that helped a lot. So with traditional trado medicine, and in fact, the king has also added verve to it to say, look, I am going that way. So what in this integrated health system and the trado medicals, and it's becoming very big in our country, how is this? What's your thought about traditional medicine, the issues of proof, test, and all that, and where does it stay within this your health sector? Thank you.
So the question with respect to the diaspora engagement and how do we tap into that diaspora workforce. I think it's important to just emphasize the point that we are working collaboratively. And just recently, I hosted some group of doctors from the United States that have expressed interest to build a medical city in Enugu, and they have funds for that already. So all they needed was for us to provide a space for them to do that. And we've continued that engagement. And I think that the decision to establish that medical city is already made and they are coming there. We're working collaboratively with them to de-risk the investment because there were certain parts of it that needed to be de-risked. We've undertaken to help with that process. So we're working to get them there. I always mentioned that I am not so enthused with the infrastructure we're doing. We had to do that anyway because it was just a force point. We had a moribund infrastructure. So even before you begin to bring people to work, you need to have equipment, you need to have tools for them. You need to have the space for them to work. So which was why there was that emphasis on the infrastructure that we're putting in. But of course, I immediately added that the human resources, the manpower was not something we are going to have a diaspora summit at some time this year, where we're also looking at further strengthening our engagement with the diasporas. In terms of the sustainability, part of what we're doing, it's building the institutions. We hope to leave an institution that would be stronger than the person, such that if you build a strong institution and you have a system in place, it doesn't matter who comes afterwards. The system would provide the checks and, you know, the balances you need for that to work. And so you, I know that you talked about how do we emancipate ourselves from the mentality of the West. But I think what we should be thinking about rather is what are those emerging skills that the lay of the land is shifting rapidly. And if we don't do something to upskill our young ones, they're going to be left behind. So we need to be thinking, how do we ensure that they are equipped with the emerging skills that you need to compete in, you know, the emerging future? So, and that's why we talk a lot about these smart school initiatives, because frankly, what it does is that we get our young ones born into technology, unlike a system. So if you look at a typical smart school that is going to be in, I'm glad to hear that a lot of you are from Enugu. Before the end of this year, every ward in Enugu State would have a smart school. And that smart school will mop up all the students from other mushroom schools. So you're going to have all the kids from all the communities go to that smart school. We've taken the baseline data. We know what we need for each ward. So all the kids in our state that are of school age will have enough room to take them into that system of education. And largely is to equip them with the emerging skills. So there will be Center for Robotics, AI, Augmented and Virtual Reality Centers. You're going to have all that skill that we'll prepare them for. So in, of course, one of the challenges we have with the traditional medicine is standards. And that's something we're working on. As you know, if you're from the medical space, it's important that you standardize. Okay, and once we're able to have an effective regulatory framework, by all means, there should be value in also creating those, tapping into those herbs. So I think that's it. And I want to perhaps maybe seize. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much, His Excellency. I mean, this was a very insightful discussion. Thank you for laying out your vision. And I think, you know, on behalf of all of us, we wish you all the best of luck to implement the vision that you have set out today. And I would also like to thank everyone who attended in person and virtually. So this event was brought to you by the Global Surgery Policy Unit. We do have a lecture series. And this time we have partnered with the Program for African Leadership. So we're also very grateful for them for making this happen. So please join us for some refreshments just outside this building. And yeah, let's keep the discussion going. Thank you.
Thank you.